Hi, this is Tom Rhodes. Please join me as I scour the four corners of the earth to bring you interesting and intelligent, funny people who will enrich your life with wisdom and laughter. I'll take you to Europe, Australia, all over America. I might take you to the peaks of Machu Picchu, the canals of Amsterdam, the Great Wall of China, or the swamps of Florida, and certainly the many, many comedy clubs and comedy theaters all over the world. Come hang out with me and meet the many interesting people that pop up in my life as I travel the world as a stand-up comedian.
You're listening to Tom Rhodes Radio.
Karate kick, baby.
Rock and roll.
Welcome to Tom Rhodes Radio. Today's episode was recorded in Seattle, Washington, with Seattle comedy legend Kathy Sorbo. I've known Kathy for over 20 years now. She's not only a brilliant stand-up comedian, but she's constantly inventing these wildly hilarious songs, and everything about Kathy cracks me up. She's one of my favorite people to hang out with. I see her every year when I go to Seattle. I'm good friends with her husband. They have a beautiful daughter, and I can't say enough good things about her. She decided to stay in Seattle and have a career based out of there, and I think she's a better person for it. She is an undiscovered comedy gem, and I'd like you to open your hearts for the one and only Kathy Sorbo. It is freaky gorgeous. I'm sitting in the backyard of Kathy Sorbo's house. Kathy Sorbo, one of my oldest best friends in comedy. And how did we meet?
Well, we were co-headlining The Punchline. I'd never met you, heard of you. And I believe on like the Wednesday night, I showed up at the club and there were, you know, some dude comics kind of hanging out, and one of them was like, oh, yeah, you're working with Rhodes. He clearly threatened by you. I was like, oh, I probably like him a lot. And we got along very, very well, I think instantly.
I think because we both drink.
Yeah. That helps bond people, doesn't it? It helps bond comedians especially.
Absolutely. And the other thing that makes comedians bond is when you think somebody's funny as hell. And I always thought you were really hilarious, and you still are, of course. But, you know, like in comedy, you know, women get a bad rep, and there's a lot of stereotypes and prejudices about, you know, women aren't funny and all that. And you certainly, I think, have always shattered that mold. You know, you're a badass rock and roll comedian.
Thanks, man. I think I have kind of a different outlook on the whole stand-up comedy situation now. I'm sort of more grounded in the home life and taking a big part of my husband's career on as my own. And I enjoy the stand-up a lot more now, actually. There's no pressure to earn money, you know, to make it a big earner. Occasionally, large productions will come through and they'll ask for me to open or warm, you know, up the audience, which is great. And I'm just really happy with what's happening.
But your style, though, you know, like before alternative comedy had the moniker of being alternative comedy, and it was the reason I moved to San Francisco was because I always thought a higher intelligence of comedy came out of there, and the people were doing like dangerous, truthful things, and that's the kind of comedy you do. I remember you always did I think it would be shocking to most people, like, you know, abortion jokes. I remember you had a big bit about getting an abortion. And I thought, wow, that was like one of the bravest things I've ever seen, not just a woman comedian do, but any comedian do. I mean, a lot of people have. But, I mean, you made it funny. It was like no remorse. I forget, what was the joke to you?
Oh, God, I'm trying to think. So long ago. I'll let you know if it comes to mind.
Wasn't it something, I think it was something like, the one thing I want to say about abortions is that it tickles. It was something like that, wasn't it?
No, it wasn't. It wasn't that it tickles, no. I don't remember what it was, Tom. You know, there are lots of bits like that people will come up to me, oh my God, remember the bit you did about, you know, wearing shit on your bra? I'm like, no. But I do remember those San Francisco days very, very fondly, and was just like, so I was going to take over my little neighborhood. I lived in the Mission, and there are little bars there, and I'd go into every bar, and if there was a stage of any kind or a microphone, I'd arrange to do, you know, 10 minutes. And, you know, for no real reason other than just to, I don't know, experience the experience.
Well, and the other thing about you is, unlike a lot of comedians, you're really funny off stage. You always, like, cracked me up. Just hanging out with you is, like, you know, people always go, God, it must be great to hang out with comedians all the time. Well, sometimes, but not all the time. A lot of them are miserable bastards. And you've always had, like, such a funny disposition. I don't know if I've ever really seen you depressed. I mean, maybe once or twice.
Huh. Probably twice. I'm pretty optimistic. I'm one of those cockeyed optimists, you know, and to a fault, really, because I always think everything's going to be just fine. Everything, you know, I always see like the big pot of gold at the end of the rainbow. And sometimes I don't see things for what I really should be seeing them as. Kind of skip over the truth to make it glossy and candy for me.
I think that's probably another reason why we've always been friends, is I do that too. Denial is a very, yeah, very wonderful, powerful weapon.
I wasn't going to use that word, but I like optimism a lot more than denial. But you're right. It is a very useful and powerful tool in coping, for sure.
Now, you know, you're from Los Angeles originally, and then you moved to Seattle when you were like in high school. And I love the story that you always told me about, oh, you're so excited, you're moving to Seattle. Wow, new friends. I'm going to have all these new friends at high school. And then what happened when you got to Seattle?
My pant legs were very small and very narrow. And I was looked at like a freak. I was not welcomed with open arms in my high school at all. I was the freak new girl, not the cool, ooh, let's get to know her new girl. It was the stay away from her new girl. And one of the counselors took me over to a group of girls and like asked them to take me with them to the Friday night football game. I'm like, oh my God, no. They're like, okay. And I tried to be all like full of school spirit and kind of whack my old wacky self, and it wasn't going over. Just a different mode of operation here in the Pacific Northwest. That, and also the Californians had been getting bad rep for coming in and buying up all the real estate and driving up, you know, property taxes. And
carpetbagger.
I know. Everyone hated the Californians. And that was difficult. I retreated and listened to a lot of Yes with like great big headphones and smoked marijuana in my bedroom secretly, and had one friend, Shauna Savage, and we're still friends. So she saved my life. We were just like, you know, totally together and for each other, and I thank her for that.
And what does Shauna do now?
She writes screenplays. And lives happily just north of here. And I see her maybe every 6 weeks.
And so you moved to San Francisco to follow your stand-up comedy career. And a lot of people, I mean, that was a really exciting time in comedy. There were so many great comedians there. You know, Greg Proops and Patton Oswalt and just a lot of great comedians. And a lot of comedians have gone on to bigger and better things. What kept you from moving to Los Angeles? Was it the fact that you had originally escaped there as a teenager? And
maybe so. I just knew that I didn't want to have to play that game, and I knew what it would involve, and it just didn't seem very appealing. I thought I could do it on my own terms. I was trying to get some kind of management, and I was willing to go down like a couple times a month to see if there was any kind of higher level of interest, but I wasn't willing to pack up and, you know, do that thing.
Yeah, I don't know why that seems so necessary in this business, that you have to go live in some shitty apartment, you know, in Hollywood and wait for the phone to ring or get, you know, fight it out to do these sets and stuff. But you've always had a supremely sparkling reputation. You have a lot of respect from comedians and in the industry. And, you've always been kind of the king daddy comedian of Seattle.
Yeah, you know, there's a few of us around that were from the old days and, you know, dabbled with fame and sort of just live more of the under the radar. A lot of the really super brilliant comics here are the tour or cruise ship deals, you know, and they're very successful at that. And, you know, the occasional club gig for them and the corporate gigs. Or, you know, here and there. But you're right. I just couldn't handle that crappy apartment, you know, the incessant heat. And, you know, just landing that part as, you know, the lesbian waitress and who's my server, you know. Ew, I don't want to have to do that. And my teeth are bad.
That was a joke I remember used to do in the old days about being a waitress and somebody leaving you a nickel.
Yeah. Yeah. So that better be dated 1408. And now I can go to the produce stand and buy that lime I've had my eye on. Waiting table's bad.
Well, but yeah, I guess, you know, you've always pursued a quality life over, you know, going after that fame brass ring. So, but you never really did the road like I did. I mean, we've been friends for years, and I think, you know, you've had a more quality life. You've lived more like a human being. I mean, it is kind of romantic, and I think reading Jack Kerouac kind of ruined my life, this romanticism with being on the road. But, I mean, do you really need to sit in Kansas City, Missouri for a week or wherever else and, you know, contemplate suicide and where you can buy... illicit narcotics to help you get through the week?
I know, huh? It is a juggle. I mean, what do you want? And also, it's like, well, to what end would that get me, you know, going on the road? And then, of course, the child that I have spewed forth.
But that came later. I mean, you married Paul, your lovely British husband, who was a former musician. And, you know, you guys chose to have a life in Seattle before you had the child. So it wasn't like that happened and, oh, shit, you know. I mean, it's almost like, I don't think you planned it. But, I mean, if you look at your life on paper, it looked like things unfolded like it was a nice plan.
Yeah, I like that. Maybe I'll make one. Show it to myself and gloat. I was right. I really couldn't be happier. I mean, look at where I live. Look at this sky, surrounded by trees and wildlife and a little garden and a table and, you know, I don't have to worry about, like you say, you know, catching that midnight flight to Clarksville, Arizona and doing this club and that I probably don't want to do. So, but, you know, there is still that part of me that, you know, likes that life. You know, I like doing the clubs. It's fun. I like doing, but now I'm doing them on my terms. I'm not having to do them for any reason, I guess. And, you know, the lack of television exposure really put a nail in my coffin for, you know, headlining out the Cobbs and, you know, the old Cobbs and the Punchline. So, you know, I just kind of got to make it happen. The way I want to make it happen here, which I did last night. There's a little tavern down the road a piece, and made a little comedy show happen there, and it was really enjoyable.
Yeah, tell me about the filthy song review that you're doing now.
Kathy Sorbo's Songs of Filth Review, which combines sort of karaoke inspired parody and intermingled with my regular stand-up. And people seem to really enjoy it a lot. You forget how people want to be like watching someone sing and dance and, you know, stick their butt out and, you know, jump around and fake tap dance. And, you know, they like it.
People want to be entertained, and you are a hell of an entertainer. I mean, you've always been really silly and very physical on stage and, you know, not afraid to be silly. But, I mean, you also like dangerous subject matter. And that, you know, so it's not like, you know, you're a buffoon or anything. Just you're just like a born natural performer. And I saw you do your Filthy Song Review last year when I was up here at the Comedy Underground. And it killed me. I was, you know, rarely. And that's why I love you so much. You make me laugh out loud. And those songs were just so perfectly you. I don't know how long it took you to write this entire show of songs. I mean, you did like, I don't know, like 8 or 9 songs or something. And mm-hmm. And they're absolutely filthy. And yeah. They're hilarious.
Yeah. Some more filthy than others. But I do love to, you know, use the word vulva in a song. I think that's important and doesn't happen very often. The songs pretty much came together pretty quickly, like within a month or so. And it was just a matter of getting them on stage and figuring out how to present it. In a club situation, you know, and stretch it out and time it and that. And really inspired from Mad Magazine, I was trying to think of what really clicked for me for, you know, writing songs. And it was Mad Magazine because they used to have those parodies. They used to have the lyrics and it used to just say sung to the tune of, you know, the Star Spangled Banner. And they were great, and I loved them. And then wrote my own lyrics and did a musical duo called The Sympathy Cards. And that has sort of dissolved and had to sing. I just had to. I was getting so bored just with the regular stand-up. Ugh. Ah. So this spices it up for me, and, you know, crowds love it. And they are filthy. And I think people enjoy that. And the songs are just so cheerful that the vulgarness is, I think, doesn't initially go in. You know, you can talk about, you know, the rudest things, but if you're singing it, you know, to My Fair Lady song, it kind of evens all the shock out.
I saw Mommy fisting Santa Claus underneath the mistletoe last night. Me out, oh, but I could not look away. Santa's pubes were debonair, a salt and pepper gray. Oh, then I saw Santa open Mommy's jaws. She gobbled down his gristle with delight. Oh, how happy I would have been if I
see my mother fisting Santa Claus. I'm not happy about it. I did see it. I just happened to get up to get a drink of water, glanced in the living room, and there it was. All happening. Right there. Weird. My mom hates cleaning up the cat barn, so this is all new.
Oh, then I saw Santa open the Mommy's jaws. She gobbled down his gristle with delight. Oh, how happy I would have been if I had never seen Mommy kissing Santa Claus last night. Oh, 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 how happy I would have been if I had never seen Mommy kissing Santa Claus. Last night.
everybody.
Well, I think that's what's so funny about it is like you really present it like they're these like monster showstopper show tunes, and then you listen to the words, it's just so funny. Like, what are some of your favorite songs from the review?
My newest favorite is sung to The Jam's "A Town Called Malice," which I've changed to "A Brown Stained Phallus," which is based on a true story of a friend who had a vibrator that her boyfriend was secretly using.
No way.
Way.
No way.
And she baited the vibrator with like a little ink pen mark. It was all smeared up when she got back from work. And
wow.
Brown Stained Phallus was born from that idea. And let's see, I guess Cougar in the...
Darling, I noticed that your butthole keeps getting larger and larger. I mean, how did she confront him?
I don't know that I ever got that story. That would be a whole nother song. But in the song, I do suggest just take him into a shop and get him his own. He doesn't have to use yours, you know? You know, the woman's vibrator, that's like a appendage, you know, that's sacred. You don't stick it up your ass on a whim.
Well, you know, you don't masturbate or stick things in your ass with anyone else's property. And I think that's something that should be taught in elementary schools. You know, not just, you know, showing respect for other people's property, just not sticking it in your ass.
Mm-hmm.
There's a comedian friend of mine who I've been sworn to secrecy. I can't say who this is.
I'll guess.
But he told me he was a friend of his when he was in college. He had a basketball trophy that he had won in high school, and like they, you know, won state champions or whatever. And you remember those old basketball trophies where the guy's standing and he's got the ball up in
yes.
his hand. He's
yes.
raised his arm above his head and he's got the little ball in his hand. He came home and his college roommate was naked and over it, masturbating
uh-huh.
with the guy's basketball trophy in his butt.
Ooh.
It's like, hey, that's like one of the few things I ever won in my life. it's in your ass.
But that's kind of, I don't know, I'd be flattered, I guess, that, you know, it was something I won and they felt it worthy of, you know, penetration, anal penetration for pleasure. I guess there's another one, No Word Like the F Word, which is, you know, sung to No Business Like Show Business. That seems to resonate with the crowd, just the love of the F Word.
That was one of my favorites, I remember.
Yeah, I like that one. Aren't dogs annoying?
Dogs are annoying. Sorry.
Why do people own dogs? Is it like because they want children? I mean, what if I came out in my backyard and just went, for 15 minutes. It's so rude. The poo, there's like shit smell that wafts over our fence. Like, thanks for the shit smell. Good morning. I don't know. We've been pet free for years and years. So I'm kind of anti-pet. Love animals, just anti-pet.
So what are your some favorite stories and experiences from your life of being a stand-up comedian?
Well, I did go on this massive kind of college tour, which drove me to drinking even more than I normally do, if you can believe that. It was horrendous, and we went up into, like, the mountains of West Virginia, where there are, like, signs, like, hammered in the side of the road said Bob for mayor, you know, that kind of town. And I had bleach blonde hair and a lot of problems on that tour. But fond memories. Let's see, good memories. That would be, I recently did a couple years ago, I was on a bill at Cobb's with Dave Cross and some other TV people. And died a miserable death on stage, which doesn't happen to me. But I mean, the whole fucking crowd hated me from on site. It was very, very difficult for me on stage and off and for several months afterward. But the next night I was at the Throckmorton Theater, Mark Pitta's room.
Love that room.
And it was like, thank you. You know, I was like mayor of Throckmorton City. and people were hugging me after, you know, that really made me feel good. That was one of my, I just loved that feeling, you know, just feeling so better. It was like kissing the boo-boo, you know. Developing relationships with so many people that you keep in touch with over the years, seeing them go on to, you know, fame and fortune is really nice, over the jealousy and the envy, which I still kind of experience. Seeing beautiful cities, performing in England was awesome, right? Kind of right before the comedy boom hit. A lot of comedy in town, but the boom hadn't hit. Eddie Izzard, I did a gig with Eddie Izzard when he's like just a normal cubicle guy, you know, shirt and pants guy. And seeing where he went was fun.
It's funny what you're saying about, like, you know, dying the miserable death at Cobb's and then doing a great set at the Throckmorton. And it's funny how, like, fragile, the ego can be as a comedian. Like, I had the reverse of that last night at Laughs in Kirkland. The first show, I was a comedy god, and I just absolutely destroyed. And I thought, God, I got a handle on this. And then the late show just sucked a donkey's dick.
Oh.
And, you know, it's just funny how you can go from total elation to... I'm going to go somewhere and have a good cry.
Yeah. I think I actually did shed tears when I got home from that San Francisco trip. There was like really bad things online and it was like really hard for me, you know. But, you know, stand-up comedy is so fulfilling. It's just so fulfilling for me to spend 40 minutes and entertain and get the accolade and make people feel better. And I got some of that too when I wrote the column for the Seattle PI, the paper version. I'd write about, gay rights or something that was happening locally. And I'd get these like such sweet letters. Thank you so much. No one's ever said that kind of thing. I blow, you know, that kind of thing. It's just a beautiful experience. And it's nice to be able to have that in your life.
Well, what about, like, the negative criticisms? Like you said, like, things were written online. And that's an interesting thing about being a comedian in today's world, because I've got tons of clips on YouTube that I actually, you know, I lovingly edited them with a professional editor and put these pieces together just to entertain people. And I've had some really pissy comments left. Like, there's one... On London Cockney accents, and you know, you always look at who made the comment, and it's always some like 20-year-old fuck who, it's like, why do I give a fuck what some 20-year-old in Hertfordshire whatever fucking thinks of my joke? But you go, oh God,
yeah, because you know you can please everybody. It's happened, you know, when you know you can please everybody. Anything less, you feel, I think.
Yeah, but it's also funny that, you know, like you said, you got the, when you wrote for the Seattle PI, you know, you'd get these wonderful messages. And I do get beautiful emails from people. I think the greatest one I ever got was a few years ago. This guy wrote me, and his grandmother had died. And he said, everyone knew she was dying, and she's in the hospital. And he got to have his last time hanging out with her. And they were watching Comedy Central in the hospital room. And he's sitting on the bed with her. And he said, my special came on. And then they laughed. Mm. And they watched it. And then when it finished, they talked about, you know, the things that I had spoken about. And the guy said, I just want you to know that the greatest memory I'll ever have of my time with my grandmother was watching your Comedy Central half hour special. And so, you know, that is one of the most beautiful things anybody's ever wrote to me. But do I think about that? No, I'll think about some fuck.
Yeah.
Some 20-year-old wrote.
Oh, I know.
Or just some pissy comment. So it's weird that we're that fragile. Well, maybe not you. I mean, I'm probably more sensitive than you are.
No, I'm really super sensitive. But maybe that's part of the reason I kind of backed away from the exposing myself as much as humanly possible. You know, it's like, I don't know if I want to kind of be rejected on a high level, you know, or who knows what could happen. You know, even if it was to the point where I was really famous, that somebody would take my picture with me without makeup on, you know, showing all my chins and neck skin, it would be, I'd be mortified, you know? So that grandma, aren't you glad she didn't like flatline during? That wouldn't have been a very nice story.
It would have been a whole different email. You killed my Grammy. That's brutal. So what do you think have been your toughest experiences? It's almost unfair, and I've never done this to you, but I'm just feel compelled to ask you this. But as a woman comedian, because I always say, as hard as it is to be a comedian, period, it's like 1,000 times harder to be a female comedian. Because then, you know, you got club owners and other comedians trying to fuck you, and then it's just a lot more difficult for a female comedian to get started. But your advantage is that you don't do your typical. You know, if I saw you walking on stage and I didn't know you, I would not guess the subject matter that's about to come out of your mouth. So I think that's been your advantage. But do you think, what are your thoughts on that? Or, you know, can you give any advice to up-and-coming female comedians or any comedian?
First of all, no one's tried to fuck me. I'm a little pissed off about that. That's a good question. What kind of advice? I suppose, I guess, trusting yourself to relax and not sort of have to try to sound like a comedian, but sound more like you. I think not wearing tight clothes would be a good, you know, until you're supremely confident, because it's distracting. And when girls and boys are on a date together, men won't laugh because they don't want their wives or girlfriends getting pissed off at them. Now, somebody told me that after I was wearing something. I didn't think it was particularly tight or revealing, but apparently it's a little distracting. I said, okay. I'll never wear that again. I wore it every night. Every night. You know, when I was working with MTV, and I'd go out to New York like every couple months and do these little vignettes and work out these little interstitial spots, and nothing ever got aired. Nothing came of it. And when I asked why, they said, oh, well, the demographics changed now. Oh, and also there was mention of me being too old for MTV. I think I was like 35 or something. So 35's too old. It was too old then. Demographics changed in the matter of a year. Very fickle. And I think difficult to stay on top of. I think dudes have always had a easier time in show biz. It's just how it is.
Well, and what about the getting old part too? Because I'm hearing that now. My manager is one of the producers of the Chelsea Lately show, and I asked, hey, you know, can I get on that show? There's a lot of like young comedians on there making like 10, 20 grand a weekend now just because they're on that show. And I like the format of comedians sitting around and slugging it out. But that was what I heard. Oh, yeah, he's too old. I mean, I think, you know, this love of youth in our country, and especially in show business, which created that love and worship of youth, is, you know, and I can't really complain because I was, you know, young and cute and got on television. But I'd rather be the comedian I am today with my world perspective and a little bit more wisdom and better stories to tell. Mm-hmm. You've always been hilarious, and you always knock it out of the park. And
except for that time at Cobb's, the Dave Cross show. I struck out there.
Well, what went wrong?
I think I was just too goofy and wacky. and animated.
For the hipsters?
Yes, exactly. You know, they wanted, I think they were, you know, wanting to that more cerebral, you know, cynical. And I am just so not cynical. You know, I'm too happy and go lucky and optimistic and in denial. But I was going to say, with age, I think, you know, we own it. We own ourselves more at this age. And I've had the best shows. I think back to when I was young and the demographic for TV or whatever. I didn't know shit. And I think I just cringe when I think about, you know, my sets back then with, like, no perspective. You know, talking about, oh, I hate kids and, oh, they're evil and they ruin your life. And, you know, I was going to have my vagina all sewn up and, you know. And why isn't all the crowd laughing? Well, that's because they have kids, dipshit. And they know you don't know what you're talking about, you know. So now I just, the crowds are like younger than me or my age. And it's just so much more enjoyable.
Well, that's funny too, because your daughter, who I absolutely love, and that's because, you know, you've raised her to be such an artsy, cool, funny human being. We were talking about this one of the last times I was here, how, you know, you didn't like now how when you hear a comedian get on stage and talk about how much they hate children.
Mm-hmm.
And so now I think it's funny that you tell me that, you know, you had a bit like that when you were younger.
Yeah, totally. And I mean, I really kind of wrote on that premise too. And thinking back, you know, I can still kind of extract some of the material. But, you know, now that the crowd knows where I'm at, and I can work it better to my advantage, you know. And it's just a whole new world of comedy.
Well, how much material have you gotten out of being a mother and having a child?
A lot. I mean, a lot. I mean, I can go back, tell stories from, you know, insemination. I know exactly where I was inseminated. I was in Portland, Oregon, as a matter of fact, at the Comedy Condo. Woo! Harvey's, yep. Comedy Condo.
She's, your daughter's so lucky her name isn't Harvey.
I know. So my advice would be never to use a condom that comes disguised as a gold coin that you find. So, yeah, I mean, it's a huge part of my stand-up. Huge. You know, and I can also just make up shit and say that my daughter said it, you know, and she didn't. And it's really good. It's a useful tool, parenthood.
Great. You have someone to blame things on now. You just opened up the whole idea of parenthood for me. So, but I don't know. I you know, I've always been a fan, and you've always been a great friend of mine. That's just not bullshit words. You know, we've always been tight. I think you were always a great person, but I think having a child made you even a better person. And you know, one reason we've always been buddies is we both like to drink copious amounts of booze.
Mm-hmm.
And do you think it's, what are your thoughts on?
On being a better person with the child in the life? 100%. I think I've learned selflessness to an extent, which was not really on my little list of to-dos. Yeah. And moderation and patience. Holy crap. And it makes you grow up, makes you mature. It makes you learn more about yourself and what you can pull out of your bag. And it's huge being able to influence a child, i.e. not bring them up, you know, fearing God and Satan, i.e., you know, free of religion, but open to all sorts. You know, we don't poison her mind, but we definitely steer her towards what we think is right, which is a gift, you know. And also reproducing out of the American gene pool, huge. I recommend it. I think it builds for a smarter child rather than interbreeding with other Americans. So that was lucky.
Oh, the fact that your husband is British.
Yes, yes. And it improves your life. It challenges you to the max. And it's just so enjoyable. I just look at her sometimes and just think, oh, my God, she's so awesome. And other times it's so I'm just going to want to pluck her little eyes out and pour salt in the gaping holes.
Okay, what if she, you know, like in high school, she makes some religious friends or something. What if she comes home and says, "Mom, you know, I'm Christian or Hare Krishna," or would you just, "No, you're not. You're grounded. Go to your room. You put that Bible in the trash." I mean, what are you going to do?
I'm very confident that she's going to make the right decisions. I don't think she'll fall prey to any cult. And she knows she knows that if she wanted to go to church with, you know, Piggy Ann, she could totally go. I said I would take her. If you really want to go, there's a Lutheran church right up the street. I'll take you. I'm Lutheran, but it's boring. It's boring. It's weird. But if you want to go, I'll take you, and you can see for yourself. She's free to make her own choices, and she knows that.
That's funny. You know, I dated an Iraqi girl when I lived in Holland, and she would always go, "Damn Lutherans." Like, whenever it was like there was some bullshit with America on the news, she was always says, "Damn Lutherans." Like, and I was like, "What are you talking about?" She was like, "Well, from what I've read, it's the Lutherans that cause all the problems." And she was an Iraqi Kurd, which, you know, they get along with no one. But I just thought it was funny, for some reason in her head, she had it that the Lutherans were the main cause of the problems. Like, why them over the Methodists? Or what's the difference between a Methodist and a Lutheran?
Well, I think the Lutherans would just bore you to death, is what it is. I don't really know anymore. I just remember being in church, and I liked church when I was a little kid. You know, I was in all the like musical programs and in the choir, and loved the harmonies that came out of those old hymns, you know. And then I went to my friend's Catholic Wednesday night rock and roll mass, and also went to a friend's Mormon service. And, you know, when my little Sunday school teacher caught wind of that, she told me basically not to do those things. It was like, that's wrong. And then my mom wore pants to church, and she was like, you know, banned.
Wow.
Pants. We really think it's because she was divorced, but they used the pants as an excuse. And then I had a cheerleading competition to go to in seventh grade. And I had to miss choir practice to go to the cheerleading practice for the competition. And the freaking choir director said that I had to choose between being in choir or being a cheerleader. So I chose raw. And I thought that was just sick. So that was about when I dropped out of you know, the whole church thing, you know, 12, 13 years old, as I was done with it.
What were you telling me before about, you know, we were talking about, you know, the strange stories in the Bible. You were like, yeah, talking serpents and...
mm-hmm. Yeah, the weirdest things that they come up with, you know, the Garden of Eden. Everyone was all naked and enjoying everything until the talking serpent talked. Come here, Eve, check out this apple. Eat it. And then, of course, everyone had to wear... you know, bushes on their bushes and cover up their boobs with leaves. What the fuck? Jesus, I thought, always looked kind of sexy to me. The long hair is always kind of handsome. I thought I kind of had a crush on Jesus when I was, you know, little, thinking, oh man, he'd be a great
date. That loincloth hanging right beneath his pelvis bones.
What's under that sheet anyway? Pictured Jesus and me going to prom. Bring me a little corsage of thorns.
That would be hilarious. So what would you say your religion is? You know, that's one thing, the great thing about America, you know, is if you don't find a religion that suits you, you could always invent your own. So, I mean, what would be the religion you would invent?
I wouldn't invent anything. I would just take up with nature, you know. You know, God didn't give us this day. This day did. You know, waking up and experiencing the day gives you the day. You know, someone recovering from an illness in a hospital, it wasn't Jesus, it wasn't prayer. It was they did it. Their body worked again. It does that sometimes. But, you know, there's too many religions and it's all muddy and all being used to for evil instead of good. And that's I think that's the nail in religion's coffin now, you know, what we're seeing today, how it's being twisted around and how these televangelists are being, you know, busted for who they are and the hypocrisy and the non-Jesus-like behavior of these God-fearing people.
Yeah, like the televangelist who killed my father from being three times over the legal limit.
Yeah, like that guy. Like yeah. That guy, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That fuck.
God.
Yeah, he's going to need plenty of prayer after I get all... No, whatever.
I think you should maybe get a hold of that basketball trophy before you go visit him.
But one last thought on your beautiful child that you created. And, you know, you were talking about, the selflessness was the word that you used, which perfectly sums it up because, you know, I'd known you for years. And then, you know, after you have your daughter, I see you waking up early, mm-hmm. you know, when I stayed with you a few times and you're chopping little carrots, finely little, mm-hmm. you know, digestible cubes for a little 5-year-old mouth. And then, I remember when she first started going to school, you know, you told me like some kid had thrown a rock at her on the playground. And me, just as your friend, I had this bubbling cauldron of anger and white violence, steely cold violence in my veins. And I wanted to go to the school and punch out that 5-year-old. I mean, and now this child came out of you. So your feeling must have been that times a million.
Oh, yeah. And in fact, I went and surprised her on the playground once in first grade. And she was sitting all by herself. I'm like, what's going on? She goes, well, I was over there, but they won't let me play with them. You know, the group of girls, you know. I'm like, they won't. Well, let's take a walk over there, shall we? And find out exactly why. She's like, all right. So, because I did ask her, I go, do you want to play with them? She's like, yeah. I'm like, okay, well, let me see what I can broker. So I'm like, hey. Nova here, she says that you don't want to play with, or is that correct? And the one girl's like, they're all silent. I'm like, is that correct? And the one girl goes, well, it's only because she... And then the other girl put her hand over the other girl's mouth. Well, she's just bugging us. I'm like, oh, she's bugging you because she wants to play with you? Yeah. I'm like, oh, well, why don't we go find some other friends that want to play? You know, that kind of thing. And I was so mad. I was just like, oh, like you said, like white sheets of lightning, you know. Poor little Nova, she does no wrong, to, you know what I mean? She just wants to play. And I was shocked that it happened in first grade, you know, like, Jesus. So I said to Nova, as we were walking back, I'm like, fuck them, Nova, fuck them. She's like, oh, I'm like, I know, but fuck them. That's all I could think of. You know, Nova kind of giggles, you know, at the expletive being used on the playground. And, yeah. And, you know, something else, there was another occurrence that happened recently, just in sixth grade, that I had to kind of step in and take hold of and shake out and, you know, call this girl on her actions. And that'll never go away. I hope to fight somebody's mom eventually.
Now, I would pay for that on pay-per-view. Seeing you, yeah, fuck UFC fighting. Let's see mothers going at it whose children have had issues. My sister has a 12-year-old son, and he just started eighth grade. And she's telling me, like, how ruthless these kids are. And they're, like, really mean to him. And, I mean, they're all mean to each other. And they say these nasty things to him. And she was asking me, you know, as a professional comedian, can you, you know, can you give him a little stockpile of comeback lines mm-hmm. that he can say? And I'm like, oh, my God, yeah. And I love mm-hmm. the kid. He's, mm-hmm. you know, he's cool and artsy and he really loves music and stuff. So I'm rattling off all these nightclub comebacks. I mean, how great. I wish I was 12 and yeah. a professional comedian had filled me with comeback lines. And she's like, oh, I can't say that. Oh, I can't tell him that. I'm like, well, why did you ask me?
Yeah.
I mean, do you want the kid to be picked on or not? I mean, shut your cock washer. I mean, what 12-year-old is going to come back to that? Shut your man pleaser. I mean, and she's like, I can't tell him that. So I gave him, like, probably the cleanest one that I could think of was, hey, the asshole Hall of Fame called. They need an updated photo.
Uh-huh.
And so the kids used that, like, 15 times on everybody. She's like, do you have any more? I'm like, give him the cock washer. Tell him the cock washer.
That is a good one. Yeah, Nova and I, we practice comebacks. She's got a thing going on with this girl in her class name. I believe it's Claire, who loves Justin Bieber. So,
you just painted an image that's perfect.
Yeah.
Claire.
Yes, she says things like, you know, I think I'm the prettiest girl in the world. And, of course, Nova comes back with these things, and I'm laughing. I'm like, that's hilarious. You know, use her to your advantage. So they go at it, and I think Claire said something about, Nova has all of her permanent teeth in. They were talking about teeth somehow. And Claire, the Justin Bieber fan, says, you know, I still am missing a couple teeth. And Nova said, yeah, a lot of Justin Bieber fans are still missing teeth.
Funny.
So she's sharp, but I will tell her the cock washer.
And man pleaser. Start with man pleaser, mm-hmm. and then if they don't shut up, then you go to cock washer, and nobody can come back from that. And it's battle tested.
Yeah.
What are some of your greatest comeback lines for hecklers?
I recently had one. Some guy was being a dickwad, and I asked him what he did, and he said, guess. Guess what I do? I said, you're a stay-at-home dickwad. And that was really good. That was pleasing. There's no word like the F word. There's no word I love more. Everything about it's fucking awesome. I use it every fucking chance I can. Fuck's a word that's very, very useful. If you're a lady or a fucking man, there's no word that has so many uses. To not use it is a crime. Yesterday I said it about 1,000 times. I wish they'd use it in nursery rhymes. You can even say it if you are a mime. I love that fucking word. You fuckface, you fucker, fuck you and fuck off. It's a noun and it's a fucking verb. And when it slips out at a family event, the children never even get disturbed. You say it when you're driving in your car. You say it when you see a shooting star. Fuck, 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 fucky, fuck. Fuck, fucky, fuck. Fuck, fuck. So many uses. To not use it is a crime. Yesterday I said it about
So let's talk about Seattle. I mean, because you truly love it here. I mean, you've made a great life here. And, you know, this is one of the most rare, magnificent sunny days. I remember I was here in June a few years ago, and it was like, it was snowing, and it was like the front page of the newspaper said that it was colder here than it was in Alaska.
Yeah.
But I love Seattle, and it's, you know, like, I'm from Florida, and, you know, there's a certain percentage of moron that comes from all the hot places, Texas, Florida, Arizona. And I think people from these kind of climates, you know, you drink coffee and you read and you try and advance yourself as a artistic human being. I've always loved Seattle for that reason. But what are some of your favorite things about Seattle?
I love it when after winter and you get like a weird, fluky, crystal clear day. And it's all freezing cold, and you're driving somewhere, and you look to your right, and you see the Olympic mountain range fucking covered with fucking white snow. And it looks like a paradise. It looks like fake. It looks like Disneyland. You got the sparkling waters. You've got a massive Mount Rainier that looms, you know, 60 miles away. That's a big fucker. And I suppose I like... dressing for the weather and being comfortable in it. I've slunked into the Northwest attitude, you know, just a little less urgent. You know, there's a lack of urgency, which suits me now.
Well, there's just so much creativity here. I wanted to mention this to you. Do you remember the time I was playing at the Improv? I always did the Comedy Underground, and then they built an Improv here. And we went on the ferry to, I don't know, Bellingham or somewhere.
Bremerton.
Bremerton. And we missed the ferry that would have gotten me back in time for the show. And I arrived, the show like started at 8, and I got there at 9. Mm-hmm. And the middle act was stretching his ass off. Do you remember that?
Yes, I do. And I also remember you catching hell for that. And then the next day getting caught in the walk-in smoking pot.
And the manager girl said to me, I hope you've enjoyed your visit to Seattle. And she said it in a tone like I would never be back. And fortunately for me, the club went out of business 3 months later.
Yeah, good for you. That's good. Yeah, that club is now back to its original club, which was the Showbox. And enjoy lots of music there. Just saw Squeeze there.
Wow.
Saw X there lots of times. And... we need a new comedy club in town.
Really?
Yeah.
And, you know, and you and your wonderful husband, who I also adore, took me to Jimi Hendrix's grave. That was one of the finest experiences I've ever had in my life. And then you did the sweetest thing. You went and you found Jimi Hendrix's childhood home that had been moved or destroyed, and you got me a shingle from the roof.
You've got Jimmy's shingles. Yeah, it was actually being moved. It was going to be destroyed, and it was moved to near his cemetery. And as they were moving it, they did have to kind of disassemble parts of it. And yeah, I still you a piece of shingle. Yeah, and I stole me a piece of shingle too.
I still have it. It's in a glass box. And if I die, no one will know. They're like, why the fuck does he have it? No, don't throw it away. It's Jimi Hendrix's shingle.
You want the shingle? No. Do you want the shingle? No. Get rid of the shingle.
I would hate to think, you know, if I died, someone looking through my belongings. Because, like, my dad died in November, and right before Christmas, I got to look through his stuff. And it was really, you know, it was a beautiful and sad experience at the same time. I'd open a box and like, oh, my God, there's a picture I drew when I was 12. Mm. My daddy still had it. Mm. He kept it all these years. And then I opened up another drawer and I found his oral simulator.
No.
And, you know, that's something I'm going to save forever.
Wow.
I want to pass on to my children and my grandchildren. And I want.
Really? Really? Did that really happen?
It did, yes.
Wow. That's a find.
Tell us a story.
I went digging through my mother's drawers once as a child and found a clutch of tampons, which back in that day were just pretty much a cotton plug on a stick and wrapped in very shiny pink plastic. And I was very intrigued and looking at them. I never unwrapped, though, but I thought, what are these things? I thought they were all just separate toothbrushes. I thought, because it did look very kind of candy-like in the pink, wrappage. And I'll tell you another time about something else I found.
Tell me.
No, I can't tell you.
Why?
Because I feel guilty. Because my mom is still alive. And, you can go ahead and talk about your dad's oral simulator all you want without repercussion. Yeah, I hide my vibrator pretty good. So Nova found it, though. A few years back, she found this one kind of mini little vibrator. And she was like, of course, that's mommy's neck massager, of course. She knew exactly where to put it. She's like, this feels kind of fun, isn't it? I'm like, yeah, it does, doesn't it?
Mom, why's your neck massager shaped like a cock?
It goes there when you put your neck back and hold it in place, and Nova, she one day in the bathroom getting ready for school, she's like, Mommy? I'm like, yeah. She goes, did you know there's such a thing as stainless steel dildos? I'm like, huh? Yeah, really? Huh. Trying not to be like, what the? Really? I go, yeah, and then I had to up her. I'm like, yeah, they make glass ones too. Glass? Like, yeah. Well, they make them out of all kinds. They make them studded. Yeah. Spikes.
But you've always been completely honest with her. So, I mean, did you tell her what these things are for?
Yeah, of course. She knows what they're for.
this little instrument, darling, makes mommy come like a motherfucker.
And you will too someday, honey. And that'll be a special day. Then and only then. Are you truly a woman? We're all on our periods now together, which is cute. She had a horrendous one the other day, trying to wake her up. It was actually the first day of school. She's like, I don't want to get out of bed. I think I bled all over. I'm like, really? She's like, yeah. I'm like, let me see. She's like, no, I don't want to get up. So I rolled her over like a grandma, And sure enough, the massive blood stain. And inside I'm like, oh! I'm like, how many vaginas do you have? And we laugh.
She's the luckiest kid in the world because she's got you to entertain her. And she's always laughing. She's a good audience for you.
Yeah, she's good. We share a lot of good laughs now that she's at that age. And she's kind of getting into the innuendo. She loves that, The whole, anytime anyone says anything, like, ooh, it's hard, or ooh, it's soft, or ooh, it's big. It's like, which is fun. It's jolly.
I was about to talk about Jimi Hendrix because Jimi Hendrix is one of the prophets of my religion. And if I, whenever I have a child, whether it's a boy or a girl, I'm going to name it Jimmy.
Are you?
J-I-M-I. Haven't I ever told you that?
No. Huh? This is news.
That's how strongly I feel about him.
How about, can you put the middle name, Shingle?
Jimmy Shingle. I like it. But Jimi Hendrix was like such an anomaly of a human being. I mean, I don't even think he was a black guy. I think he was a space alien. I mean, he's from Seattle and did a lot of songs about aliens. And do you think that has anything to do with the Space Needle looking like a UFO?
Could be. And maybe the reason why all of his artifacts are nestled snugly at the Experience Music Project under the Space Needle. I don't know if you've been there recently, but there's an awesome exhibit of his clothes, which I think would fit me. And stack of amps that are all trash. I think Noel Redding's amp, it says Noel Redding written on it, and I don't know what.
Fall.
Dude.
It's my husband, Paul.
What's up, buddy? How are you, my friend?
Good, dude.
Good to see you.
Vice versa.
Hey.
Hey, I've been working on the car, and I didn't want to disturb you guys.
Cool. Oh.
But hey, it's too late now.
Looking good.
Vice versa, dude.
Can I say into the microphone, you're listening to Tom Rhodes Radio.
Hey, this is Paul from The Bolshoi, and you're listening to Tom Rhodes Radio.
Perfect. let me see. Do you mind them sitting here for the last
few minutes? No, not at all. Uh-uh.
All right. So let's, anything, any topics you want to cover? Things you want to talk about? Our friendship, me, you, Seattle, anything? What happened to the music scene here? It was so hot in the 90s. Eddie Vedder and all these guys wearing the plaid thermal shirts.
Mm-hmm.
What happened?
Well, they all grew up too, you know? I mean, don't forget, they were all youngins during that time, and I think their music has just sort of matured, and you know, they're off the scene. They're very private people. They still live in town. They still have their, like, rehearsal spaces here, you know? The Soundgarden people and, you know, the Pearl Jam people, and, you know, you'll see them here and there. You know, because I don't go out boozing every night, and I can't take in the new young whippersnapper bands, but they're out there, and there's a pretty decent scene if you're willing to, you know, experience it.
I remember, like, in the 90s, you and Paul took me to the Cloud Room, which was, I think, the single coolest place in the world, and that was where, like, a lot of those cats, like, in Nirvana and stuff hung out. Is that still open?
That is not still open. It's now private residences, that whole hotel.
Fucking rich people.
I know. I hate them, but love them and envy them at the same time.
Are there any interesting factoids you can give the listeners about Pearl Jam, Jimi Hendrix? I read just recently that Kurt Cobain's favorite food was Kraft macaroni and cheese.
I love it too. It must be because it's so soft and comforting. Mm-hmm.
And fat girls love it.
All girls love it. It's comfort food to the max. Let me see. Do I know any factoids? Oh, well, one time, Jim Rose from Jim Rose Circus Sideshow was in town, and he's buddies with Eddie Vedder, and Eddie and Jim and Paul went out to see, who was it? Ravi Shankar or something?
Some Indian superstar guy.
Mm-hmm. And BB, Rose, and I stayed behind at the Nightlife Lounge. Nightlight.
Yeah, Jim and I had to leave because we couldn't stop laughing.
Yeah.
We were cracking up.
They were being disruptive and making jokes the whole time. So they were banished. And then Eddie showed up and drove all of us to his then-wife's gig at another nightclub. And I remember sharing a story of a meat rendering plant trip that I took as a high schooler, and he seemed to enjoy it. That was fun. So I love those close encounters. They're fun.
Any advice that you could enrich our lives with?
Advice? I guess my husband's trying to gesture.
The future you.
Oh, future you.
Think of the future you.
Thank you. I suppose when you're tasked with decision making, always best to think how it's going to affect the future you, not the you now that wants the pudding, but the future you that maybe wants the pudding the next day and maybe a little bit the next day. So you don't eat it all for the now you. That's good advice, I think, in business and in life. It's difficult. It's difficult to stick with because I'm very impetuous and I always think about the now me. But Paul's forced me to think about the future me. And I'm thankful and resentful at the same time.
Wow, I'll have to think about that the next time I'm looking at internet porn. You know, and it's a funny thing, like, and it's such a, and you know, you and your husband Paul are the reason why I buy Apple products before I even bought a computer. You advised me to go with the Macs, mm-hmm. and I'm forever grateful. And that's what we're recording this on. And I think it's amazing with technology is, if you think about it, the internet is the sum total of all, it's free access to the sum total of all knowledge. And 99% of the people just jack off in front of
us. I admit doing a lot of image searches for Ronaldo. I admit that freely. Right. So did Paul.
Oh, tell the Alex Rodriguez story. That was great because you used to have this great bit about Alex Rodriguez.
Yes, who I lusted after during the 1990 four season or five season of the Seattle Mariners when they used to win. That was great. And loved him, loved everything about him. He was just a luscious thing with the perfect skin that's like a McDonald's cheeseburger bun, just perfect smooth brown. I would do all these like lustful bits about him. And one time in San Francisco, he actually showed up to one of the shows and sat in the audience with another Mariner at the time, John Marzano, RIP, and some chicks, of course, and like kind of Amazonian muscular chicks. And he and I did my whole lustful routine right in front of him. And then we'd pass drinks back and forth to each other, buy each other drinks, and hung out. I was with Eddie Brill. Eddie Brill was headlining. So he can back me up on that. We hung out and chatted with little Mr. Alex.
That's awesome. I'm so surprised you didn't end up married to him.
Yeah, sorry, my cock washer was taken at the time.
What joke have you written in your career that you're the most proud of?
Oh, that's an easy one. I used to live with a mortician. Yeah, it was cool because I'd wake up already dressed with my clothes on. It's a time saver, people.
Okay, so this episode is all about Kathy Sorbo and the greatness therein. Paul, as her husband, are there any interesting facts or stories that you can share with us about the magnificence of the woman you married?
Yeah, I remember when she came over to live in London after we met, when I was on tour in the United States, and she came over to England, lived for a year, and I watched her perform, and I saw comedy for the first time, and I was kind of like amazed at how rude English people were to American comedians. I was ashamed. They were just assholes, cocky, arrogant bastards. And it made me think a lot about the English way. And now I've been here since 91. I'm kind of glad I'm here.
And, but more about me. More so about me.
But yeah, Kathy, well, she's just a very remarkable woman. She's very very talented. I'm really glad she didn't decide to scoot off to LA and become, go that route. Get on TV shows and this, that, and the other. And yet at the same time, it was very tempting at the time. She kind of resisted it. And now, we're broke for eternity. And we're in it.
Well, what's the funniest story you can tell us about Kathy?
Okay, the funniest story.
Or something that made you laugh really hard. Just things she might have said, or
actually, I think one of the funniest things is when I actually hear her laugh at something, because living with a comedian, they're not walking around cracking jokes all day long, and and when I actually hear her laugh at something, specifically if it's something I say, I just really like that. I like making her laugh. But again, it's all about me. What about Kathy?
Here, give me the mic back. It's all about you. How come English people can be so pissy with non-English people, but they can't take jokes about themselves? Because I've done.
Got a clue.
British people can talk about it, but you can't say anything. A joke I did was I love to read. I'm constantly reading. I finished a very thin book today. It was all about the history of British Olympic champions. It was more of a pamphlet, really. A comeback I've never gotten to use is I've always wanted to get heckled by some English people, fucking with me for being American or something, and say, hey, listen, all I know is when they were passing out the phone country codes, we were number one, and you were number 44. There were 43 countries ahead of you.
That sums it all up, yeah. That year in London was rough. But it took me several months, but I did find sort of a clutch of performers that were booking shows that were welcoming, and really enjoyed my last couple of months there. But kind of a typical thing. I went to a club in Greenwich where Malcolm Hardy, I'm sure you've heard his name.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Up the Creek. I love that room.
Yeah, it was Up the Creek. And I was going on, it was my first time there, and I was nervous and doing, you know, 10 minutes at gig. Yeah, a lot riding on it for me. And right before I go up, he goes up and does a whole 10-minute bit about how fucking stupid Americans are. Blah, blah, you know, I mean, getting the audience into like a lather of hate. Your next comedian is from America. But you know what? I did it. And he had to kind of humble himself and came up to me and kind of congratulated me for making it through and doing a good set.
That's awesome. And a lot of comedians in England do that. It's just, you know, talk about how stupid Americans are. And Up the Creek, I love that room. And it's actually, it used to be really notorious where people would go there just to
be mean to
the comedians.
Yeah.
And it would be rabid audiences drunk and heckling people. And the greatest story I heard about Malcolm Hardy was and they call them the fruit machines, the little slot machines.
Yeah.
He had introduced this comedian, and then he's on the side of the room and he's playing the slot machine. And the comedian had done some joke, and the crowd all starts yelling, "Hey, fuck you, that's Malcolm's joke. That's you took Malcolm's joke." And Malcolm Hardy sticks his head in the door and goes, "No, that's his joke, mates."
I'm just so not about that comedically, you know, like dishing it back at, you know, I'm just so non-confrontational with my stand-up, you know. So that kind of turned me off about London, is because that I know a lot of the crowds, that's what they went expecting to do. I just did not enjoy that.
What are some of the most unique benefits or setbacks being a comedian in the Northwest in Seattle?
Well, I suppose kind of the lack of regular work, regular club work. It's very limiting. There's a lot of clubs and a lot of stage time, but not very many full times, and they don't, you know, the pay is very, very low. I'll get called to do like a weekend where there's all kinds of shit going on downtown, and for less money than I know, you know, it's just like not very respectful, I think, of the headline talent that's here. But I think it's a very good place for the youngins, for sure, to be here and then also have access to the Portland scene, which is growing too, which is good. But I think it's also unique in that you can have a life and also satiate your need to perform and make a little cash on the side if you choose. You can kind of design your career here rather than kind of have to go through the hoops that normally you might have to do in a bigger market.
I think there's a great comedy scene here. I mean, this would be a great place to move and develop as a comedian the way San Francisco was in the 90s when we moved there. And then also you've got Bumbershoot here, which I think some of the most popular shows at Bumbershoot are the comedy shows. And I remember it was like 10 years ago. I had come up and I had never even heard of Bumbershoot, and I thought it was a really cool festival. And I saw you perform there, and you ripped the ass off that place. And I actually got to do Bumbershoot last year, which was really cool. God, what was the point?
I think just being up here and the things that are available for a comedian or a performer. Theater shows are huge, you know. Also, you don't get a lot of love from the press when you're doing stand-up. It's kind of the redheaded bastard stepchild of the entertainment industry, still a little bit. But ooh, if you have a one-man show at the La 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 Theater, then you know you're on the NPR doing the interviews, which is kind of weird, I think. But heck, whatever. But yeah, I think it's a fine place to come and settle. And still get your stage time.
What do you think about all the hipsters here? And this has always been populated with, you know, hipster coffee drinking. I've got a cute little goatee, kind of people.
Yeah, and those are the women. I think they're adorable, and I think that also the comedy scene for those that genre is done a lot in terms of reviving a stand-up scene. So happy to have them. And they got the energy and the time, which is important to sink into generating some kind of working and visible comedy scene.
My favorite thing about you as a comedian is, you know, you're always reinventing yourself, you're always evolving, and now you're doing the shows with the Songs of Filth review, which is fantastic. And, you know, you're performing at you're always at a higher level, and every time I see you, you're just, you know, you're raising the bar. You never really kind of relax. But like I said earlier, you know, you're a born performer, and you've taken me out to some really cool karaoke nights, and you've brought the house down singing. And my favorite song that I ever saw you sing in karaoke was Deep Purple's Highway Star. Mm-hmm. And to this day, that's one of my favorite songs ever. Because it always reminds you belting it out. So could you end this little podcast with singing Highway Star for me?
Yeah. Cue the music. Well, how about I sing my Songs of Filth Highway Star?
You got one?
Yeah. It's called Porno Star. Okay. Okay, just pretend there's been like a minute and a half of musical buildup, okay? A la Deep Purple. Let me see if I can remote. I'm on my back, camera's ready to roll. I know my lines, I've hit my mark. I got thick boobs and a hairless twat. I am a high-end porno star. Ooh, I'm a skanky hoe, but I'm in demand. Na-na-na-na. Ticking it up the butt with two in my mouth and five in each hand. I suck it, I lick it, I am it. Wow, wow, wow. Hey, there's jism in my eye. All right, hold tight. I'm a porno star. There you go.
That's fantastic.
Thank you. Thank you very
much. Okay, so how do you want to end this? Do you have any closing? What's your favorite thing about Tom Rhodes?
I guess your affability, your honesty and truthfulness, and likability, your sweet disposition. Your cock washer is good. Very, very good. I guess just you just exude niceness and kindness. I like that about you. And you're not too hard on the eyes.
Yay. That's lovely. Lovely. And then the niceness can really hold you back in this business. Because, like, when I had the sitcom, I was too nice, and people walked all over me. And in retrospect, I should have, like, thrown some tantrums and kicked over the water cooler and stuff. So, but no, thank you for the lovely compliment. So now, is there anything you'd like to say to the people of the earth that might enrich their lives in any way?
Think of the future you. And if you don't, my husband will kick you in the ass. And you'll find that I think your future will be better when you coddle and nurture the future you.
Well, thanks for always being one of my best friends in life, Kathy. Yep. I love you very much.
I love you too.
All I want is for that down there to be free. Smooth as a toddler's
Yeah.